Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Ah, can't you see it? The world powered by solar and renewable energy. Here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at Graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Good morning, folks. Hope you are having a great Thursday morning, January 16th. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We'll visit with Rafael Goyeneche in the 12 o'clock hour. He is the president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll talk about the most recent ruling by Susie Morgan of the NOPD moving into the sustainment phase of the consent decree. We'll also get an update on the Bourbon Street attack, and we'll talk about some recent crime stats. In the 11 o'clock hour, we will be joined by Joan Alker. She's the executive director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy. Recently, there's been some information released from Congress that they are considering a significant cut to Medicaid. We in Louisiana should be very concerned. More than 50% of our population receive some type of assistance from Medicaid. And we are a Medicaid expansion state. Well, they did a study that shows that Medicaid plays a bigger role in providing health care coverage for people in rural and small towns, sounds just like Louisiana, right, than in urban areas. And we'll talk about the implications as well as it relates to obstetrics, the delivery of babies. You will be completely shocked with some of the data that comes out of this study as to the future of health care in this country. At 10:30, we are joined by Billy Nungesser, Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana. We'll talk about a lot of different issues, the Super Bowl. We'll talk about bollards. We'll talk about Mardi Gras. We will talk about the Keep America Beautiful conference, as well as where we stand with Louisiana Beautiful and a number of other issues with our Lieutenant Governor. So there has been an agreement between Israel and Hamas on a ceasefire, a release of hostages, and already in the immediate aftermath of that agreement, there is some troubling revelations about whether or not Hamas is trying to change the terms and conditions of that agreement. Officials involved have said this is a complex arrangement. And Hamas has a history of backing out of these deals. 468 days the hostages have been in custody. Hamas broke ceasefire deals with Israel in 03, 07, 08, and nine times in 2014. And they walked away from any number of offers recently since the October 7th horrific event in the months of December, January, February, March, April, May, June, and July of 2024. So they really have a bad track record, and it's going to be interesting to see whether or not we can reach phase one in order to get to phase two. And here to talk with us about it is Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. Colonel, thank you for joining us this morning. We truly appreciate it.
Always a great pleasure.
So, Colonel, officials that were part of this process say that this is a very complex arrangement. You heard what I said about the history of Hamas and walking away from this. What is your appreciation of what is accomplished by this ceasefire agreement?
Well, first of all, I think what you outlined was exactly correct in terms of how Hamas has conducted itself. As far as bringing this agreement to a close, it's also important to realize that there's strong opposition in Israel, one of the delays of the moment at least, as well as some suggestions that Hamas is trying to change the deal. But the Israeli cabinet has not ratified this particular agreement. And that has now been postponed, and I don't know if it'll happen today or happen tomorrow. The problem being that several of the very conservative members of Mr. Netanyahu's cabinet have refused to endorse the treaty, have refused because they believe they should recommence hostilities after the initial tranche of about 33 hostages are, in fact, released. And if they don't endorse it, then they could actually take a vote of no confidence in the Knesset and bring down his government. So there's some problems on the Israeli side as well. But I think the operative phrase in this, or the operative adjective, is temporary. This is a temporary ceasefire, as you say, though, very complex arrangement that will allow about 30-plus hostages to be released, about 1,000 Palestinians, and then after 16 days, start negotiating phase two, which will be the rest of the hostages for additional Palestinian release, Israeli military moving out of the Gaza Strip but maintaining buffers on the northern end and along the Philadelphia corridor near the Egyptian border. And then if we get through that, then you get to phase four, which perhaps is the most important in many ways, because that's the one that we'll talk about establishing some kind of political authority and reconstruction that, if infected, would bring stability to the region.
Obviously, there's interest by Hamas in order to hold their organization together, right? I mean, that doesn't go away.
In a way, though you can understand it from the Israeli perspective, the despicable things that Hamas did on October 7, 2023. But at the same time, in terms of just of flat negotiations, the Israelis have said that their goal is a total destruction of Hamas. I was always personally a little skeptical whether you can destroy an ideology. You can destroy its military capabilities. You can kill its political leaders. Not sure you can destroy an ideology. But destroy Hamas and get the hostages released. Well, in a way, those are contradictory objectives, because the only leverage Hamas has as they lose more and more military capabilities are the hostages. And once they're released, then the possibility of the Israelis moving on even with greater fervor in their second objective of destroying Hamas has no impediment. So there's always been a bit of a contradiction there that we've been trying to straddle as these negotiations have gone on. And frankly, what's interesting, of course, is this particular agreement is basically the agreement proposed by President Biden back in May. I mean, we've been basically talking about this for now for about 8 months.
Yeah, not much has changed in that regard. What's interesting to me is that, and the reason I said that Hamas is going to do the things that they need to do to try and keep Hamas together as an organization. Right. Symbolically, when you look at the list of individuals that they want to release, and I think this is one of the first bumps in the road, Israel wanted to retain the right to be able to veto whatever the request was as to who is going to be released. And obviously, Hamas puts at the top of the list the mass murderers that killed more Israelis and others than any others, obviously looking for that symbolic oomph, so to speak, as it relates to their ability to negotiate hard deals with Israel. This is what's happened every time. Israel gives up 100 prisoners and Hamas gives up a dozen.
Actually, even less than that. I mean, if you look back to the release of an Israeli soldier a few years ago, I think they released about 1,000 for one Israeli hostage. So you're exactly right in terms of raw numbers. That has been totally disproportionate. It appears that we're talking about 1,000 Palestinians in the first release. It's important to understand, though, that many, if not the majority of those Palestinians, were probably detained on the West Bank and not detained in Gaza and transported because the Israelis have a longstanding detention policy and over the course of this conflict have detained thousands of people. And in many cases, to be perfectly frank, detained people without any opportunity for them to have any kind of judicial review. If you're arrested on the West Bank and you're an Israeli, you appear in front of a regular civilian court. If you're a Palestinian and you're arrested on the West Bank for the same transgression, you appear in front of a military tribunal. And that's just the way law has been established. So the first 1,000, you're exactly right. They're talking 150 to 250 of the Palestinians released have life sentences for various things that they've done, probably involving the killing of Israelis. But about 560 are going to be women and elderly people who have been held for some time by the Israeli authorities.
So if Israel decides to exercise that veto or what, however they refer to it, or the right to, you know, not approve of it, I think it's kind of hard for Hamas to swallow that, right?
It probably will be, because, of course, they've got their own constituencies they've got to deal with. And you're exactly right as well. What you said already, Norman, is for Hamas, what is their objective? If Israel's objective, and they said this over and over, is to destroy Hamas and get the hostage released, Hamas's objective in these negotiations is to survive in some form, to survive. And that, as a consequence, that means they've got to establish or try to maintain some level of legitimacy in the eyes of those who support it. So that's why I think they would continue to be very insistent on the particular people that they're arguing for to be released. Now, that being said, it does appear that those who are released, even if they were detained on the West Bank, will be released in Gaza and not released back on the West Bank, where they would have connections and whatever, and perhaps could, you know, pick up where they left off.
Colonel, are you surprised, and maybe they've done it and they've just not released it? I mean, I've been completely mystified by the fact that we've had no proof of life process that has gone on. We've
right.
talked about these numbers generally. They're saying that there's 33. Mike Waltz on Fox the other day says that they've confirmed that there's 25 alive and probably the remaining eight are dead. But it seems to be a moving target. And then in reporting this morning, they talk about having found two more people that they believe might be alive. I mean, it seems to be, I don't know, it's a weird process. I mean, usually you engage in some kind of proof of life procedure early onset, wouldn't you?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is where Hamas wants to have it both ways. They would like to be treated in many ways in negotiation as if they were a government, which they are not. They're a government that was elected for the Gaza Strip, but they're not internationally recognized. But if they're a government, then they would have to, in terms of the laws of armed combat, be subjective to those laws, which would be the identities to the Red Cross of those people who have been captured. By the way, you wouldn't take hostages to begin with. That's against international law, but at least you'd tell who they are. But in this case, I think what's going on is two things. One is that they are trying to extract every possible concession they can get in any way, shape, or form for anything that they would provide the Israelis. So that type of information, valuable to the Israelis, would only be provided at some price, at some concession. And second of all, what worries me the most is they may not know, because there's real reason to believe that a number of the hostages are not held by Hamas, but are held by other groups, Islamic Jihad, or even criminals that are in the Gaza Strip. So they may not have absolute knowledge of the names of all the hostages even, or certainly their particular status, dead or alive.
But if that is in fact the case, I've never negotiated one of these deals, but just as a lawyer thinking about bidding against myself, the agreement's not worth the paper it's written on. Because if Hamas doesn't really have control of the Islamic Jihadist or these criminal organizations within Gaza, what am I negotiating and with whom?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's what makes this particular negotiation so unbelievably complex on the one hand and, frankly, problematical on the other hand. The possibility of getting through phase one and getting 33 hostages, which, in fact, I'm pretty optimistic that Hamas has in hand, that may have a pretty good probability. Going beyond that, that's where things may actually get really difficult. And then getting to the third phase, where you start talking about what's going to be sort of the political governing authority of this region that's going to respond to the destruction that's occurred in the plight of 2 million-plus Palestinians, that really gets even more problematical.
So do you really go through this process in order to test the strength of Hamas and how much control they actually have over Gaza? Because it seems to me one of the byproducts of this situation at this juncture is they may not have that much control.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's certainly one of the byproducts of the particular negotiation. But all sides as well have their own particular responsibilities at home. And clearly there's, and for very good reason, has been an enormous groundswell amongst the Israeli population to do everything possible to get these hostages released. And, of course, the demonstrations you can see on the news on a regular basis outside the Knesset just underscore that. So the Israeli government has a responsibility to do everything they can within reason to secure these people's release. But again, there's other objectives, and that's why I said, for example, at the top, there are very conservative people in Israel who are opposed to this agreement, and they had very high positions, a couple of members of Mr. Netanyahu's cabinet, who A, don't trust Hamas, B, don't think we're going to get anything beyond 33, and C, therefore, insist that the Israelis recommence hostilities once the first tranche is completed and skip phase two and phase three and just go back to war. They have other objectives, though. They are very outspoken that they really want to formally take over the Gaza Strip. They want to formally evict the 2 million people that are there. I haven't really said where they're going to go, but get them out of there and fill the Gaza Strip back with settlers and make it into Israeli territory. They are also very outspoken about formally annexing the West Bank, which they call Judea and Samaria, not the West Bank, and expelling a large number of the population that are Palestinian there and expanding the number of settlements. One thing that's occurred during this war, which hasn't gotten, I think, a lot of coverage, is the Israelis have significantly expanded the number of settlements on the West Bank with Israelis and pushed out more and more Palestinians, even while these hostilities were going on.
Well, obviously, Hamas and Hezbollah and Fatah are their closest territorial enemies, right? But isn't really the bigger existential threat Iran? And if there's not some
Absolutely.
Kind of Iranian component to this in working with the Arabs and others and Qatar or Qatar or however they say it, you know, it would seem to me that we kind of lose sight of who actually is being funded, financed, and you know, who the true allies of these folks are that are really the thorn in the side of the Israelis more so than anybody else.
Well, without question. I mean, the Israelis would tell you the ultimate problem is always Iran. Iran was the place that Hamas received funding for its military. It's where Hezbollah, in particular, received an enormous amount of funding. And at this particular moment, of course, Iran is probably in the most vulnerable position it's been in, frankly, for decades. Its two primary clients have their military capabilities largely destroyed. Hamas, clearly, but even more importantly, I think in some ways, Hezbollah, which was really the ultimate deterrent for Iran by the hundreds of thousands of rockets and missiles that Hezbollah had in its possession. And so always the way deterrence would work was if the Israelis struck Iran, the Iranians would unleash Hezbollah to fire thousands and thousands of rockets on Israel, and therefore a delicate deterrence balance existed. Well, for the Iranians, that deterrence is gone. And furthermore, these Israelis, in response to Iranian attacks, have done two missile attacks on Iran, destroyed a lot of their air defense capabilities, destroyed some factories that provide propellant for Iranian missile systems. So Iran is about as vulnerable to a big attack by Israel as they've ever been. And furthermore, the Iranian economy is really in very bad shape. There's reports of electricity blackouts. There's reports of the currency hitting one of its lowest levels and a lot of social unrest. So the Iranians really are facing, I think, as Mr. Trump arrives and being so vulnerable with two options, and the Israelis will be part and parcel of these discussions. A, they quickly move to some kind of negotiation with the Trump administration on their nuclear capabilities, or B, they accelerate their efforts to acquire nuclear weapons to reestablish some kind of deterrence. And that's a powder keg that Mr. Trump and his incoming administration, along with the Israelis, are going to deal with.
It would seem to me, I don't know, I'd love to know your reaction, that President-elect Donald Trump's comment about all hell will break loose in the Middle East was really not directed toward Hamas or Fatah or Hezbollah, but really right at between the eyes of Iran, knowing that they could exert their influence on these organizations to capitulate to some of the demands of the West.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. But I think the other component of that was it also was at the Israelis. And the biggest argument Mr. Netanyahu has with the conservative members of his administration is we don't want to anger the incoming Trump administration. We want to annex at least the West Bank, maybe not Gaza, but we want to formally annex the West Bank. And the Trump administration will support us in doing that. I mean, you look at the ambassador that's been appointed to go to Israel, Mike Huckabee, who is an evangelical Christian, as we all know, and very supportive of the idea of this is Judea and Samaria. It's truly part of Israel, has been part of Israel for centuries and centuries. It was the Trump administration in the last term who acknowledged and supported the Israelis formally annexing the Golan Heights. It was the Trump administration, of course, that moved the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem and recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So the Trump administration in the past has been very supportive of those aspirations by the Israelis, and I think they expect they will be so again. But the price of admission, I think, for Mr. Trump is you got to bring this agreement and bring this war to a close.
I'm not a betting man, but I don't know.
I wouldn't bet on anything in the Middle East whatsoever.
Colonel, you know, it's one of those things, the more you read, the kind of the more confused you get, right? And it's just right. So many. This is like a chess game with pieces that we've never seen before on a board. And
Well, you know, not to cut you off, but what really we need to, I think, understand is this particular war and its aftermath, the destruction of these proxies of Iran. And we're skipping over, and we haven't even talked about the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria.
Yeah, in Syria.
In terms of the overall region, this is equivalent to the end of the Berlin Wall. This is the end of the Cold War. I mean, this is all the pieces haven't been rearranged on the chessboard. They've been thrown up in the air over the chessboard. And so there's an opportunity for a significant realignment in the region that might bring stability. But also, in every opportunity, there's a danger. There's a danger for renewed, if not expanded, violence.
Well, Colonel, we got to get to a break, and we've run out of time. We really appreciate your time and your insight. We know you're busy, and I love the way that you're able to kind of put this in the most order and structure, not only for me after getting confused, but I think the listening audience as well. And we really appreciate your time.
Well, hopefully, I don't think we cheered anybody up, but hopefully we provide them a little bit more perspective.
You're absolutely correct. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year to you. That's Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. We'll be right back, 504-260-1870 on the Okwunar Jewelers Talk and Text Line. When we return, we'll visit with the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Louisiana, Billy Nungesser.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
Hey, football fans, are you obsessed with the game?
Oh, yeah.
Do you find yourself looking for breakdowns from every angle? For those who can't get enough, subscribe to Brian Baldinger's podcast, The Best Football Show, where he discusses the top teams and players from around the league each week.
That's what I watched this week, a dominant performance.
New episodes drop every weekday, including Trench Talk Tuesdays with former NFL lineman Mark Schlereth. Make sure to subscribe to The Best Football Show on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Just stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Louisiana, Billy Nungesser. Lieutenant Governor, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Newell.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. In the aftermath of the tragic event on New Year's Day on Bourbon Street, there's been a lot of chatter about bollards, and you sent me a video the other day, and I've seen the video several times. It's probably been viewed over a million times by now, about bollards protecting the Jackson Square area out in front of the Puntalba and the the Cabildo.
Yeah.
The bollards that are there, you could just go up and slap them, and they go back and forth, and it's not much of anything.
Yeah, those have been broken off over the years, and over 2 years we've been trying to get them replaced because, coming up to Jackson Square, you've got to take a hard left on St. Anne Street, and if you've been out all night or not paying attention, you go straight through Jackson Square, where people are always, there's always a crowd there. So it's been a very dangerous situation for years. Several cars, you know, of course, broke those off that are now missing. And we've been very fortunate no one's been killed going into that square before now. And, you know, hopefully we get some response and permanent barriers put back in place to protect that pedestrian mall.
Has the city been in contact with you? I mean, I know that in the past you have worked with the city. Your employees have been deploying those ornamental barricades that on Royal Street. I think y'all are still doing it, maybe. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But have they been in contact with you about what's actually going to happen there? You know, you're responsible for these beautiful structures in Jackson Square. Any communication at all?
Trying to work with the city for the last eight years. I've been lieutenant governor, and the frustration is just boiled over with this latest tragedy, whether it's street lights or drainage or fixing the streets and safety issues. They put some plastic temporary things in place. They didn't fill them up water, so you could just tip them over. Then I believe they filled them up, and then I understand yesterday they came and removed them. What's going on there?
So right now there's nothing there. But back to the communication, have they reached out and talked to you about the plan or anything?
Have not. You know, I know they've hired some expert to come in and look at all the safety issues. You know, early on in many of the discussions about managing the French Quarter separately, one of the things that was brought up was the fact, even when the balusters were in place on Bourbon Street, if you didn't have a balcony on that corner, there was nothing to stop you from going on the sidewalk. And the recommendation of putting a permanent post in the middle of those sidewalks on every corner was recommended way back when. So, you know, in many cities where you have walking pedestrians, you'll see that, and people just walk around them. It doesn't obstruct the sidewalk much, but it's right there to stop any kind of vehicle from going around on the sidewalk. But just like the permanent ones that were there on Jackson Square, it doesn't take a security study or a specialty hired to know those things need to be put immediately to from coming into those areas with a vehicle.
Right. Let's pivot to another conversation. We have the 2025 Washington Mardi Gras Ball coming up, the 76th one, and Lieutenant Colonel Roderick Rico Alvendia, a New Orleans attorney, founding partner of the firm Alvendia, Kelly, and Demarest will reign as king, and Kendall Williams, a recent graduate of Louise McGee School, will be the queen of the celebration. Talk to us about it, Billy.
You know, that is a great event. It brings all Louisianans together. I wish we could invite more guests to see those festivities to promote Louisiana tourism, but as you know, it sells out every year. This year, Louisiana Seafood Promotion Board will be bringing back the Wednesday night oyster party, where we'll have oysters from all over the country, in an effort to highlight something we've been working on, and that's trying to get Congress to pass an inspection fee of about 10 cents a pound on imported seafood, to hire a lot more inspectors and inspect that foreign seafood coming into the country to give our local fishermen and farmers a little bit more of a level playing field. So we hope to use that event, as there'll be people there with oysters from all over the country, the East and West Coast and all the other Gulf states, to talk about how we collectively support some import fees to get those inspections up. It's something I've been working on for years, and hopefully with the new president and Congress and the political stroke we have in Louisiana, and I've gotten every lieutenant governor to support our efforts, which ought to help us get some more congressmen and senators on board to finally get some of that legislation passed.
I saw a recent report of how much foreign product is brought into this country, and even still in this state being sold by a number of retail establishments. It's astounding. I mean, it blew me away.
Well, you know, I want to thank the legislature and Dr. yesterday. We moved report in this train who already has those inspectors in place that's going to do the inspecting and testing. And hopefully we'll tweak that bill a little bit this year in the session to give more authority to not only impose those fines for people that are mislabeling and misrepresenting domestic product with foreign mislabeling. We've seen it all too often. People need to know what they're eating and where it's coming from. We do have that. It has to be on the menus now. Most recently, I've gotten a lot of people feedback, walk-ons. We partnered with early on to promote Louisiana shrimp, now uses imports. You'll see it on their menu. A lot of people were shocked that homegrown company forgot how they grown quickly by using Louisiana products. So we want to make sure people ask before they eat and demand Louisiana products because it's at a critical time for our fishermen.
No doubt. You will be participating in the Keep America Beautiful conference coming up, and I think your role is going to be talking about litter abatement.
Yeah, you know, this is the first year that I'll be participating, having Keep Louisiana Beautiful now under the Lieutenant Governor's office, and it'll give me a chance to interact with the other states, and just like I do with the other lieutenant governors, to find out what's working in their states, where they've been successful implementing laws, education, enforcement, and cleaning up their states. I've worked closely with the officials in Tennessee that had a similar problem as Louisiana, a very dirty state. They've made great progress in cleaning up their state. So we want to make sure we keep our foot on the gas. You know, people can sign up right now for Love to Boot Week. Over the last couple of years, we've seen that week of cleaning up Louisiana grow from about 50 groups when I first took it over to over 750 groups last year. And for the second year in a row, all 64 parishes had groups. And this year we're shooting for 1,000 organization groups to sign up at Love to Boot. To clean up Louisiana. Not doing that week, but it's a good week to kick off cleaning up our state.
Absolutely. Are you participating in the Super Bowl parade?
We have a float in it, and the one thing we can't throw Louisiana Feed Your Soul stuff like we usually do, but we'll have a couple travel riders and people riding to get the feel of the festivities of riding on a float and hopefully write some great articles about Louisiana. We're also real excited this year. I want to thank Bacchus. They are recognized in all the fairs and festivals all over the state of Louisiana, and each float will highlight a different fair and festival. I'll also be riding in that parade, and we'll be doing a lot of press around the country, highlighting those beautiful floats by Bacchus and how they represent the Strawberry Fest, the Seafood Fest, the Orange Fest. And each one of those floats will have special throws highlighting those great fairs and festivals all over Louisiana. We've been trying for years to get that highlighted, and I want to thank the officials at Bacchus for recognizing that and really give a tribute to those fairs and festivals.
What I would like to see is a one-on-one video of Billy Nungus versus the King of Bacchus, Shaq.
Well, I hope I'm not riding on the same float with him, because I'm short as it is. And I would really look short if I got a ride next to Shaq.
That would be a hoot. That'd be a lot of fun, man. You versus Shaq, one-on-one.
Well, let me tell you, he is a great ambassador for Louisiana. If you've ever met him or been in an event, he spends time with the kids. He's just larger than life, literally. But his personality and his love for Louisiana, wherever he goes, he's been an unbelievable ambassador. And I'm so glad they're going to get to honor him as King of Bacchus. You couldn't have a better personality and passionate person representing Louisiana.
Absolutely. As always, we truly appreciate you taking time to join us, Billy. Thank you so much. The Lieutenant Governor of the state of Louisiana, Billy Nungesser. Have a great weekend.
You too, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. So I'm going to try this again because I destroyed his name the first time. Senator Bill Cassidy announces the 76th Washington Mardi Gras Congress and that Congressman Troy Carter is the chairman this year. And the king is Rico Alvendia and the queen, Kendall Williams, will reign. It will take place from January 23rd through the 26th in D.C. Kendall Williams is actually the daughter of James Williams, who was one of the former kings of the Washington Mardi Gras Ball not too many years ago. If you've never been, it is an incredible event. You definitely want to get there, but you definitely want to get ready to have a great time. Good place to meet a lot of folks, a lot of the power brokers throughout the state of Louisiana, a lot of industry leaders throughout the state of Louisiana. And it's looked upon as one of the best parties in D.C., second to none. A lot of folks from around the country and internationally actually attend the ball as well. So it's a great representation of the best that we have to offer from Louisiana for certain. In the upcoming hour, we're going to have I think is going to be an incredible conversation with Joan Alker. She's the executive director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy. They just released a new study relative to Medicaid. There has been some talk that Congress may make cuts in Medicaid financing funding, pretty severe. I think numbers as high as $2.3 trillion in that regard, which would represent about a third of federal spending in the Medicaid program. Louisiana is one of the top states in the utilization of Medicaid insurance. 57.7% of our children in the state of Louisiana are covered by CHIP. And the adult population, Louisiana is at the top as well in that regard. We are a Medicaid expansion state. This is something that was probably not talked about much during the election, but something that would have a huge impact in health care coverage in the state of Louisiana. There are about 80 million people in this country on Medicaid. It's about four times the number of commercial insurers. And, you know, there's all kinds of different issues with this. It's something that we should definitely keep our eyes on. And one of the things that the study reveals is that rural communities will be adversely impacted. And so we'll get to talk with Joan Alker about that. And then in the 12 o'clock hour, we'll visit with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, congratulations to Dr. Norman Francis. He is the recipient of the 2025 Humanist of the Year Award that's given by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities and Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser. So congratulations to Dr. Norman C. Francis and his family. When we come back after the top of the news break, we'll visit with Joan Alker, executive director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy, talking about Medicaid.